wish I could live like I'm longing to live.
The first time I heard KPFK, it was in the wee hours, maybe 2 a.m. Roy of Hollywood was on, right? And he was playing Alan Watts. And it was so surreal. I was like, what is this? What is this? What kind of radio is this? You know, I mean, it just blew my mind. And I got hooked right away.
KPFK.
You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show covers news and public issues affecting the areas our students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-Liss, head of journalism at Cal State LA, and we have an exciting show today. It's an election special to help you get ready for the November 5th election. My UT Community News class students have been hard at work producing this local voter guide, which you can check out online at csulauniversitytimes.com/2024 voter guide. That's csulauniversitytimes.com/2024 voter guide. On today's show, we'll hear about some statewide ballot measures that could make a major impact on audience members on the East Side and South LA. We'll also hear about measures proposed by local cities and school districts on the East Side, including El Monte and Monterey Park. Let's start with a story about why and how we vote in the first place. Voting can be confusing, especially when you work, have family obligations, juggle classes, or other activities. A lack of basic information about voting can lead many people to skip an election and miss their chance at making their voice heard. That's why social media editor Ashley Romero produced a roadmap to help first-time voters and others navigate the election. The story was cross-published by local news outlet Boyle Heights Beat, and here's a quick rundown from Ashley.
Californians heading to the polls have plenty to vote on. 10 statewide ballot measures on issues like minimum wage and affordable housing. Also in store for the upcoming election, choosing new legislators and a new president. The state of California may once again be a deciding factor in who controls the U.S. House. Perhaps even more important than that, say experts, are state and local government measures. They often have greater effects on voters' everyday lives. This is largely because federal funds and programs are channeled through states, counties, and municipalities. El Monte resident Jeffrey Rodriguez is a first-time voter. Rodriguez is eager to have a say in measures directly affecting him, like a living wage and affordable housing. Rodriguez said, quote, "It's been a long time coming for me, and I'm ready to use my voice instead of watching from the sidelines." California Secretary of State employee Jordan Riley says being an active voter is a fundamental way for individuals to have a say on issues most important to them. For UT Community News, this is Ashley Romero reporting from East Los Angeles.
Housing costs have long been a key issue in California, but it's clearly something affecting large swaths of the country. Presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have both addressed housing affordability in their speeches or platforms. And right here in California, there are several local and statewide ballot measures addressing housing and homelessness. Let's start with a local LA City measure. Reporter Haley Mosley has details on this measure to raise money to create affordable housing and bolster services for people experiencing homelessness.
Los Angeles County could get help soon with its homelessness crisis. Measure A, a proposed county ballot initiative, would introduce a parcel tax on property owners to generate funding for homelessness programs and affordable housing. Opponents say residents can hardly afford more taxes than government funds approved in the past haven't seemed to help much. Supporters say it's a crucial step towards solving the county's housing crisis. Andrew Harris has personally experienced homelessness and says the measure is sorely needed. For UT Community News, this is Haley Mosley reporting from Skid Row in Los Angeles.
Next, you may have heard ads about Proposition 33. It's a measure to expand rent control. Reporter Laura Barney and managing editor Cynthia Harbit produced a story about it.
California's rising housing costs are becoming more concerning for residents. Could the new Prop 33 make rents more affordable, or will it make them worse? Opponents say Prop 33 would hurt landlords and discourage developers from building affordable housing. Supporters say that renters' wallets would benefit from stricter rent control and renters would move less often. The ballot measure aims to overturn the Costa-Hawkins Act of 1995. It limits rent control from applying to single-family homes and some other properties built after 1995. Prop 33 would give power to local governments to set their own rent control standards. Most people interviewed agreed that rent control has gotten out of hand. Jillian Palacios of Santa Ana calls the increases insane. Other renters worry that landlords increase rent without actually using the money to make improvements. Student and Starbucks worker Natalie Gonzalez says it was literally just higher rent. For University Times Community News, this is Laura Barney reporting from East Los Angeles.
Finally, to wrap up the housing-related stories, Leslie Hudson tells us about a measure that would allow approval of local infrastructure and housing loans for low- and middle-income Californians with just a 55% vote instead of the two-thirds normally required.
San Pedro resident Isaiah Hicks' apartment is plagued with the kind of infrastructure issues that State Proposition 5 could potentially help address, like aging pipes, chipped paint, cracks in the stairs. But he actually opposes the measure. Hicks said, quote, "I think paying higher taxes to fund infrastructure and low and middle class housing will not be put toward that need properly or even at all. I thought that is what our taxes were already being put toward." Proposition 5 would lower the voting requirement needed to allow local governments in California to borrow money for infrastructure and to provide assistance with low income housing. The measure would lower the votes required from two-thirds to 55%, and it will require local governments to do annual audits on what is spent and allow oversight from independent committees. For UT Community News, this is Leslie Hudson reporting from East Los Angeles.
An issue that's coupled with high housing costs are stagnant wages. State Proposition 32 would increase the minimum wage. Here's reporter Jessica Galan with that story.
Californians struggle to make ends meet with inflation and the high cost of housing. That's why many support an increase in the minimum wage. Proposition 32 would increase the minimum wage from $17 an hour to $18. The measure is on the ballot in the November election, and it's inspired by a recent state law requiring fast food chains to pay workers $20 an hour. Opponents say the proposition could have similar problems as the fast food law. The law has been blamed for chains looking into hiring freezes and more automation of ordering and food preparation. Supporters like Jasmine Chavez, who supports herself working in retail, said a minimum wage increase would benefit the economy because spending would rise. She said, quote, "This overall sounds like a great idea because everyone works so hard, but they never have the money to show for it." However, opponents like Juan Gonzalez, an HR director for staffing, worries that employees' hours could be reduced. He said, quote, "I have nephews who don't understand the value of money. They just have their parents buy everything for them." Read more from my story at csulauniversitytimes.com/community-news. For UT Community News, this is Jessica Galan reporting from East Los Angeles.
Climate change is on a lot of our minds, especially after recent disasters like Hurricane Helene on the East Coast and the wildfires locally. State Proposition 4 aims to do something about the impacts of climate change on California residents. Editor Giselle Mauricio has the story.
Should California spend $10 billion from the state's general funds to combat climate change? Prop 4, which will appear on the statewide ballot this November, would allow the state to borrow $10 billion to reduce climate risks and impacts. Those include problems and risk related to droughts, wildfire prevention, floods, and water supplies. Most people interviewed supported the proposition. Shirley Wilson, who lives in Baldwin Park, said poor air quality has hurt her health and wants to see something done. She said, quote, "I have really bad asthma, so because of the hot weather, I think there's been a few fires recently that affected the air, and it's just really hard to breathe." For University Times Community News, this is Giselle Mauricio reporting from East Los Angeles.
Another issue that seems top of mind for most people is crime. That brings us to two criminal justice measures that are on the statewide ballot. Social media editor Jonathan Chung tells us about a proposition that would make certain drug and theft crimes felonies.
Being a business owner in Koreatown can be stressful. Many owners are concerned about crime, rising cost of supplies, increases in minimum wage, all of which make operating their business hard. But there may be a change in the air soon. Proposition 36. If it's passed, Proposition 36 on the statewide ballot would make crimes such as theft and certain drug crimes a felony. It would also divert people into treatment programs instead of prison in some cases. Supporters argue it reduces recidivism and creates safer communities, while opponents fear it may not deter crimes, could put public safety even at more risk, or punish people unjustly. Soon Ha Jin is the owner of a small toy store in Koreatown. Jin experienced a robbery about 5 years ago, and the experience makes her want to see solutions to crimes such as Proposition 36.
Yeah, long time ago, I'd say like 2018 or 2019, I got robbed with a gun. He hit me in the face and gave me black eye. My daughter had to come here to my store just to help me for the next few days. I also had to wear sunglasses not to show to the public.
On the other hand, some residents worry that Proposition 36 could even send more people to overcrowded prisons. For UT Community News, this is Jonathan Chung reporting from Koreatown.
Another criminal justice measure on the statewide ballot is one that would ban forced work in prisons. Audio editor Tupac Zapata has that story.
Proposition 6 is a state ballot measure that would prohibit the state of California from using forced labor in prisons and is supported by civil and voting rights advocates. Under the proposition, California prisons could still implement volunteer work programs to help reduce sentences, while counties and cities would need to set up pay scales for inmates. The measure's sole public opponent is the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Its members argue about its impact on taxpayers from the higher costs of running prisons without inmates as employees.
So what this does is it prohibits mandatory prison labor. And the California Constitution currently allows work as a required mandatory work as a punishment for crime. And those words would come out, and no one who is in prison could be required to do any kind of work, which would open the possibility that if the prisons want that work done, because apparently about a third of state prison inmates do work, and a lot of the work is related to the operation of the prison, like laundry and landscaping and other things, if the prisons have to pay higher wages to persuade people to work, or they have to bring in outside workers to do the work, it's going to cost the taxpayers a lot of money. And we're concerned about that because that raises the costs for in the California budget, which is already in a hole with projected deficits for several years. And why do this? What's so wrong about requiring work of people who are incarcerated for serious crimes in a state prison?
Proponents of the state ballot measure argue that California has benefited for far too long from involuntary servitude, which is written in its constitution as quasi-free labor. Under current state law, inmates can be required to work for pay that's far below the minimum wage. Wages generally range from 8 cents to 37 cents an hour, depending on the skill level required for the job. That means that an inmate can work an 8-hour day and earn less than $3. For University Times Community News, this is Tupac Zapata reporting from Cal State Los Angeles.
Statewide measure Proposition 2 is aimed at fixing up elementary, middle, and high schools and community colleges. Let's hear more from reporter Emmanuel Martinez.
Broken water fountains, bathrooms out of service, tagged walls, beaten up desks. These were the conditions of public schools attended by Cal State LA students. Many Eastside and South LA students support Proposition 2. It's a measure on this year's ballot that would allow the state to raise $10 billion to repair K-12 public schools and community colleges across California. Opponents argue that this measure will increase debt and result in higher taxes while ignoring issues like declining school enrollment. Some local residents think otherwise. For instance, Heidi Martinez attended John C. Fremont High School in South Los Angeles. She says that the conditions of schools like hers are terrible. She worries students don't feel motivated to attend class when their schools are in disrepair. For UT Community News, this is Emmanuel Martinez reporting from CSULA.
El Monte School District is taking this matter of aging infrastructure into its own hands. Reporter Kara Alexander looks into the district's proposal to upgrade school buildings and spaces.
Michael Murrow opposes ballot measure ME because he worries funds won't be used well. What's surprising about Murrow's position is that he's a years-long educator himself. Measure ME would allow El Monte City School District to effectively borrow $105 million. That would cost property owners about $30 per year for every $100,000 of their property's value. It would generate approximately $6.75 million annually. Safeguards in the measure include audits and public reports of expenses. Opponents like Michael Murrow worry that taxpayers will be on the hook. He alleges that the district has had trouble dispersing funds to areas that need it.
I grew up having pieces of shit teachers that made me feel like I am inadequate. Therefore, it's a reason why I got into teaching.
Supporters say El Monte Elementary Schools are in dire need of better facilities, enhanced safety, and expanded green spaces outdoors. For UT Community News, this is Cara Alexander reporting from El Monte, California.
El Monte has been busy. While its school district proposed a fundraising measure that we just heard about, so has the city. It's proposed something similar. Reporter Jose Cabrera researched a proposed tax hike to maintain funding for city services like fire protection, park upgrades, and senior and youth programs.
Potholes, the common enemy of cars on the road and the people driving them. They cause tire damage, blowouts, and huge bills for drivers. El Monte voters will consider Measure EM in the November election. This measure aims to raise money to improve current infrastructures like roads and sidewalks and provide programs for youth and seniors. The measure would hike city sales tax from 0.5% to 0.75% indefinitely until $3.5 million is raised annually. Supporters of this measure said it is needed to help youth and senior programs, especially for those facing financial hardships related to caretaking. Opponents, like Andrew Land, say that tax increase isn't the right call. People are struggling to make ends meet after several years of rapid inflation. Opponents worry the money generated could also be misused by city officials. Land said, quote, "This is going to cost somebody a lot of money. Can our poorest residents afford any more taxes of any kind? Inflation is killing the lowest income earners right now." For UT Community News, this is Jose Cabrera reporting from El Monte, California.
Not far from El Monte is the city of Monterey Park. Community News Editor-in-Chief Queen Adong reported on Monterey Park's request to voters to update its business license tax.
The city of Monterey Park wants to raise $1.2 million in funds to keep public areas and businesses safe and clean. It also wants to prevent crimes like theft and to strengthen the local economy. You could be thinking taxes will rise, but actually Measure BE is unique. Measure BE on the November ballot will revise the business license tax rate to $75 per $1,000 of gross receipts. A city staff report says there could be no change or even a decrease in the tax amount for some businesses. Meanwhile, others like doctor's offices and retail shops will see increases. Supporters say using the money to improve how the city looks could bring more tourists. That could strengthen the economy with new jobs and more tax revenue. But not everyone supports it. Some business owners interviewed questioned if the city could solve its problems by throwing money at them. Business owner Jason Chen opposes the measure. He's worried about the impact on his business. Since a restaurant is running a lot of operations, this could mean suppliers will increase their prices. That in turn could increase costs for businesses like his. From UT Community News, this is Queen Adone reporting from Monterey Park.
That story and all the others that are part of UT Community News' voter guide this year can be found on our website, csulauniversitytimes.com/community-news. That's csulauniversitytimes.com/community-news. You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel Liss. After the break, our community news editors will share snippets of their favorite work from the past year. Stay with us.
It's comforting to belong to a group, even when you're out among strangers. The moment you spot someone else wearing your favorite team's ball cap or a sweatshirt from your alma mater, you sense an instant kinship. That's sort of what it feels like to be a KPFK member. Together, you, with other contributing listeners, make a real difference in keeping this service alive and well. When you run into fellow KPFK members, you know you share similar core values and a responsibility to support the programming you enjoy. Please become a part of this important group now at 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Or go to kpfk.org and pledge securely online.
We're back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Tupac Zapata, an audio editor for the University Times Community News Outlet. Today, the other editors and I will share tidbits from some of their favorite stories from a previous semester, and you can read the full stories online. Let's start with my story about a cafe in Northeast Los Angeles that has won the hearts of its customers and almost broke their hearts last year when it closed.
Four months. That's how long Silver Lake and neighboring communities went without tropical cafe. No guava pies, no café con leche, no AA meetings in his community room. Its future was bleak. But then three regulars decided to take matters into their own hands. In March, they reopened its doors. Danny Corunzi, one of the new owners, is thrilled they've been able to rehire some of its employees who were laid off previously.
So we have three of the original staff from Cafe Tropical, and then we have three other staff from, we have Laura, who was at El Cochinito for many years, and then we have Jimmy and Esteban, who were at, one of them was at Cochinito and one was at Bolita. So we kind of got as many of the staff between between those and brought them here. It's been real special to see just the outpouring of everybody coming in, both from the recovery community and just the neighborhood, and people that have just been patrons of the cafe for a long time that are just happy to see us back.
Tokshio Yoye has been working at Tropical for the last 6 months and says he's happy to work alongside his longtime friend. Shoyoye said, quote, "It's nice to work with someone I like because I have worked for people who are not so nice," end quote.
Cafe Tropical is not just a cafe with delicious coffee and pastries, For the last 30 years, it has served the recovery community northwest of downtown and hosts more than 30 support group meetings from several fellowships in its community room. It is a place where many folks found sobriety after struggling with drugs and alcohol, and it is also a place where many folks say miracles happen.
For UT Community News, this is Tupac Zapata reporting from Silver Lake.
You can read the full story at csulauniversitytimes.com/community-news. Our next story is from Ashley Romero, one of our three social media editors for UT Community News this semester, and who looks at making public meetings easier to access from the northeast neighborhood of Herman.
How do you feel when you are excluded from important conversations? When neighborhood councils don't keep residents posted, the community can feel out of the loop and less invested. Less than 1 year ago, I attended my first council meeting. It was about finance and outreach in Herman. Here's a rundown of what happened that night. It's dark. I park, then walk to the building where the neighborhood council meeting is supposed to be held. I see people standing in the church parking lot across the street. There's no open door in sight or even a clear sign or directions. Confused? I pull out my phone, go to the Herman Neighborhood Council website, and click the Zoom link. Maybe I can catch the meeting online and ask someone to help me find the meeting in person. I get nothing. The link is invalid. Later, I reach out to the Neighborhood Council to find out what happened. Council member Nicole Mahaka said, quote, "There's a Zoom link?" Council member Catherine Harrington chimed in too, saying, quote, "I didn't know a Zoom link was even available. Sometimes we show up 10 minutes before, or we join right before the meeting." When council members found out, they apologized and mentioned that Zoom links weren't used for recent meetings. They do want to start using Zoom in the future because of the passing of a recent state law, Senate Bill 411. Senate Bill 411 requires a legislative body that chooses teleconferencing to also post agendas, identify locations, and have accessible teleconferencing with clear communications. I was glad to hear it. This is an important step in the right direction in making public meetings more accessible to the public. Still, there's a lot more work for Los Angeles neighborhood councils to do to better engage the public in issues that most certainly affect them. This is Ashley Romero reporting from Herman.
Now social media editor Giselle Mauricio tells us about the trials and tribulations of a street vending family from East Los Angeles.
About 17 years ago, Esther Hernandez left her home country, Mexico, for a better life. Street vending in Glasso Park provided that life, but when her husband fell ill, things changed. It seemed the life they built together might end abruptly. That was life, she thought. It was always hard. She thought back on her reasons for coming to the U.S. for a better life. She couldn't attend college in Mexico because students had to pay for everything there. And she knew her parents would have had to struggle a lot to make that happen. So she moved to Los Angeles, staying with a family member at first. She slept on the floor and felt very unwelcome there. There were many nights she cried, wondering if she should return to Mexico. But she tried to focus on her future and her desire to make her family proud. She worked many different jobs in those early years, and cleaning homes was one of the better ones. Those were tough days. Sometimes clients would pay her. Other days they'd say they didn't like how she cleaned their home or she used the wrong cleaning product, and sometimes dock her pay. One day, a neighbor suggested selling elotes en raspados as a street vendor. Despite her fears and risk posed by the job, she decided to go for it. The first year was the hardest. She said in Spanish, quote, "There were even times where I'd walk the whole street and I wouldn't sell even one thing." It was discouraging, but she noted what sold, what didn't, and where certain items were more popular. Occasional criminal activity on streets and the fear of operating without a permit were additional challenges. She remembers feeling grateful for warnings from some other vendors, like one time when she said, quote, "A fruit vendor was there and they started taking away their things. So they told us to be careful because the health inspector is down there. Eventually, she found success selling elotes and raspados in front of a local elementary school. And her husband, Julio, helped by covering another good route.
Thank you. All right, whose is this one for?
You want chili on yours, Anna?
Yeah, everything.
Everything on it?
Everything.
Yeah. You like that?
Corn?
You like this?
Corn?
Yeah,
corn. He makes them here.
They have...
Elote. All right.
Over the course of 1 year, selling at the same spot, she got to know the community and the people in the neighborhood. Longtime customers noted how kind she was, and she marveled at how grown up some of her customers got over the years. Life was finally not just easy, but good for Esther, Julio, and their daughter, then 10. They had each other and a community. But the 2020 global pandemic changed a lot for everyone, and it was no different for the Hernandez family. Esther said, quote, "We couldn't even go out to work, and watching the news made me panic. How am I going to do this? How will I live if I'm not working?" Then worse news hit. Julio's leg was swollen due to an infection he had. Doctors surgically removed the infection and told him it would heal. But a week after being discharged, he noticed two small black dots on his leg. Doctors examined it and found that the bone underneath was already dead. Julio couldn't believe it. It didn't work anymore, and I couldn't feel it. Soon after, doctors amputated the part of his leg that was infected so that it wouldn't spread. They were both more frightened than they had ever been. Esther said, quote, "It was a moment where the world had crashed for me." Julio wondered what the point was. "I was thinking, now I'm useless. I won't be able to walk. I won't be able to work like I should. I'll be stuck in bed sitting or laying down. What am I going to do?"
Well, in that moment, frankly, I was desperate. It was really horrible. But what am I going to do? So then they tell me over the phone, you know, "We're going to have to amputate your foot and you're going to have to sign these papers." Then my wife tells me, "You know what? You're going to have to sign them. If it's for the best, sign the papers." Then I had no choice and I had to sign the papers, and they told me what was going to happen with the anesthesia, how long I was going to be in the hospital. And then for the time I was there, and then they amputated my foot, when I came out of surgery, I started spinning out, and I said to myself, "I'm worthless, I won't be able to walk anymore, I won't be able to work like before, I'm just going to be in bed, just sitting down or laying down, what am I going to do?"
All he could do physically now was cry. He fell into a deep depression. Esther recalled, quote, "One time he opened the car, tried getting on, and he fell. I just heard screaming, so I went out and he was on the floor in the street." She found out later that it wasn't a simple accident. He had wanted to hurt himself. Julio eventually agreed to therapy, and after 2 years was much stronger mentally. He got a prosthetic in 2021 and soon after was back on the streets selling with Esther.
For me, it was hell. Well, when they told me, "You know what? Everything is fine now. We're going to give you a prosthetic so you can be able to walk. But look at me now. I'm already walking, even though it's slow, but I'm walking and I'm able to overcome this."
It's not the same as before, but Esther is thankful for what they have. She said, quote, "The three of us are together anywhere we go. None of us are sick or anything, and that's a win." For UT Community News, this is Giselle Mauricio reporting from East Los Angeles.
You can read the full story at csulauniversitytimes.com/community-news. Now, let's leave you with an inspiring piece about a gym owner dedicated to helping his community by encouraging a healthier lifestyle through fitness. Jonathan Chung, a social media editor for UT Community News, has the details.
Tony Lozano grew up in South Central Los Angeles, where he said gangs, violence, and gunshots were common. It seemed few local businesses promoted a healthy lifestyle. That's a big reason why he helped start Fuerza Gym in the area a few years ago. His co-owners and close friends, Gustavo Castillo and JC De La Cruz, shared a similar vision for a place one could get away from the stresses of everyday life, powerlift, and get fit. In the past decade or so, he has been pleased to see more healthy markets and cafes springing up.
When I was growing up in South Central and Crenshaw, it wasn't always like that. There was always violence going on, shootings, always gang members trying to attack innocent people here on the streets.
Lozano himself was a victim of school bullying and communal violence. He vividly recalls an after-school attack on himself at his high school.
It was after school, and I just remember these teenagers who would be troubled around my block. Punk kids, I'm not sure why. I guess for their enjoyment. Anyway, they saw how small I was and just wanted to scare me, knowing who controlled which block, and I was punched and kicked. Thankfully, they didn't take anything from me. But things like that just occur for no reason.
This incident initially affected his self-esteem and confidence, but he sought help from his friends and family, talking to them and getting their advice help. He made use of thrift store items to create a backyard gym.
I made my gym at home, my backyard. A little bench press, a couple of dumbbells, a kettlebell, random bricks, water jugs, stuff like that.
Over time, Lozano secured a job and purchased his first gym membership. But the pandemic meant that commercial gyms were overcrowded and potentially not safe. So he, his friends, and then-fiancée, Mia Ruby, worked outdoors and eventually formed Fuerza Gym after getting a loan from the bank. During an intense recent training at Fuerza, Taylor Ramirez, encouraged by her trainers, pushed 120 pounds on a shoulder press machine, breaking her personal record of 98 pounds. Ramirez, a member of the gym, says she's a fan of his workouts, cardio routine, and calorie counting program.
I've been here for 2 months, and so far I've lost around 7 to 9 pounds, which is an amazing goal for me.
Another gym member, Alexis Morejon, said the coaches keep you on your toes.
Tony, even sometimes Gustavo might be on me because I'm not doing something right. They're like, yo, you got to be able to push that weight. They scream at you respectfully, but they're going to push you, and I feel like the other gyms, you could hire a personal trainer, but they won't even tell you your form is wrong.
Andrew Gafford, owner of Bottle Bar Liquor Store at 6042 South Crenshaw Boulevard, said limited access to quality food and high obesity rates create health issues in the neighborhood, and local gym can often help with that.
We don't have the best quality food here in Crenshaw. Rent's high, gas is high as shit, everything's high. You're going to want to buy cheap food to survive. Yeah, it's going to mess you up, but it's sure damn cheap and keeps your tummy full.
In addition, Lozano's wife, Mia Ruby, says she envisions opening a vitamin shop to educate children and adults about healthy choices, emphasizing the couple's holistic approach to wellness.
Right now, we're trying to have our own vitamin shop to try to teach kids and adults what to drink. We shouldn't be drinking Gatorade since it doesn't have enough magnesium and it has so much sugars and chemicals.
For UT Community News, this is Jonathan Chung reporting from Koreatown.
You are listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Tupac Zapata. After the break, October is National Disability Awareness Month on campus, and we'll tell you how you can learn more about how to support those members of our community. And we always see celebrities lining up on the red carpet for film festivals, but lining up to go inside a prison for one? We'll introduce you to a Cal State LA alum who's using what he learned on campus to help those inside and outside prison walls get their stories told. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Denise Akbari, a reporter for KPFK's Cal State LA Community News Hour. I was thrilled and beyond honored to contribute my story without love or money, which is part of the Race, Class, and Gender in American Journalism Class project, Herb But Hopeful, and my story, Buried Dreams, produced for the UT Community News Class, to the show. KPFK has helped me reach a bigger audience by making my reporting accessible through a different medium. Cal State LA Community News Hour has also helped me learn how to record and produce audio stories, which are real-world experiences. This is a great opportunity. Thanks so much to KPFK's staff and volunteers for allowing me to be part of this.
KPFK, your community radio station.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In-depth news coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. There's a straightforward reason. It's no longer profitable for commercial media. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare. It requires a large and talented team of researchers, reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KPFK is more important than ever. We continue to bring you comprehensive coverage from skilled, dedicated journalists because you continue to support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK and join the KPFK Sustainer Circle, or you can give at kpfk.org.
We are back with the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm April Brown. October is National Disability Awareness Month, and Cal State LA is using the 31 days to promote diversity and inclusiveness with its own Disability Acceptance Month. The Office for Students with Disabilities, or OSD, has come up with activities and educational experiences to help us all be more mindful of each other's needs. Gonzalo Centeno is OSD's director, and he spoke with me earlier about what's coming up.
We've now done these events probably, I think, for the last 13 years with OSD. So it's become an annual event where we reflect on disability challenges, but more importantly, just understanding disability and also creating a more inclusive environment for individuals with diverse disabilities. And we think about it and we put it in perspective for the campus community, but obviously this message transcends outside of the university.
What are some of the things that we can do day to day to make sure that we're being inclusive and, celebrating diversity? Because it does, it might bring challenges, but it also does bring us benefits as well.
Absolutely. So we work quite a bit with academic accommodations. So that can be anywhere from providing note-taking services to interpreters, to sign language interpreters, or even testing and accommodations. And I think because we work so much with academic accommodations, I think really is creating course content that is, we go for the term what's called universal design. And so we always want to make sure that we create a learning environment that is conducive to all students. Sometimes, for example, we could talk about providing captions on videos, which is something that may be an accommodation, say, for a student that is deaf or hard of hearing. But in reality, having captions on videos also benefits other individuals. It could be someone that has a learning disability, or simply it could be someone whose English is a second language, and that also benefits. So this is an example of what we call universal design, where we create something for the benefit of a particular population, but then we understand that it benefits more than that population. So there's different things that we can do when we think about creating an inclusive environment, is understanding that if we want the campus community to participate or to be feel included, then we need to ask ourselves questions as, is my event or is my class inclusive? And what can I do to make it more inclusive? What are some best practices? So Disability Acceptance Month kind of sheds lights on different types of disabilities, different challenges that is experienced by the disability community, but also it can also work on understanding what those challenges are and understanding just how the community works in general.
You're mentioning that other people can benefit from accommodations made to people with certain disabilities, but we also may not recognize that a certain person has a disability because it's not always something you can see. So can you talk about trying to make sure that we're mindful that those disabilities are things that might not be obvious?
Yeah, there are many invisible disabilities. And because invisible disabilities sometimes can come along with a stigma attached to it, the many times the individual doesn't reach out to get assistance. And I think understanding that there can be disabilities that are invisible, understanding that there can be challenges associated with the disabilities, it's important to be mindful, especially when the individual approaches you about requiring an accommodation, for example. We want to make sure that we listen and that we have a better understanding of what that accommodation could be. And then being open to providing an accommodation.
You've got a lot of programming on this month that is designed to help make sure that we can all work towards a more diverse and more inclusive community. I've noticed that there are things like navigating interviews and job search for neurodivergent people, which is really interesting because unless you are neuroatypical, you might not think that there are things that you can do to improve the process.
This is important. We often think about what it means to be neurodivergent and what it comes with and some of the characteristics associated with neurodivergence. And so it's many, and it's an umbrella that encompasses many, many different types of disabilities, including but not limited to autism, learning disabilities, and other cognitive challenges students may possess. So while students are able to get through their academic program and complete everything successfully, there's that next step. The next step is going out to get a job, okay? So some of the concerns can be, you know, what's the best way to interview? Like with any other student, what are some tips? How can we better prepare? How can we prepare resumes? How can we prepare cover letters? And then there's the job. How do I disclose to my job supervisor that I have a disability and that I need accommodations on the job? What is the best way to do that and how to approach this in a more proactive way? So this workshop will touch on a lot of those questions and a lot of those concerns that students may face as they're approaching the end of their academic career and getting ready to go out on the job market. The other one that looks really, really great, and I've seen student panels in the past, and trust me, student panels are incredible because the students that participate on these panels are always very candid, and they're very honest about what it's like to be a student with a disability at Cal State LA or just in higher education, what have been some of the challenges experienced, and what are some of the things that they've done to succeed in this environment. And what I've always appreciated about these panel presentations, again, it's that whole genuine expression on behalf of the students to be able to give the campus community a better understanding of the disability perspective. We have our 2K Journey as one of the big staples of Disability Awareness Month, where we do a walk around the track and just, you know, it's where you do that whole walk at your pace, do what you can, do only what you can, or just join us, just be there and join us in the celebration. And then we have our book club coming up on October 29th. This semester, this year's selection is Disability Visibility by Alice Wong. So if anyone is interested in getting a copy of the book, we will be providing a limited number of copies for free. And then towards the end, we're going to have one of our fun events, which will be Halloween Silent Disco and Costume Contest. Now, I had my first opportunity to go to a silent disco this past spring during Neurodivergence Acceptance Month. And so what they do, I don't know if you've seen the silent disco, but you wear the headphones. So you wear headphones. You adjust the volume of how loud you can hear the music in your headphone, and you're dancing.
Because that's always the problem at concerts,
and
right?
You're dancing with other people.
It's too loud. I'm, you know, going deaf. Yeah. I totally get it.
Yeah. So this is super exciting that we're going to have it for Disability Acceptance Month, and I'm looking forward to it.
Gonzalo Centeno, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The easiest way to join in the fun is to go to your browser and type in Disability Acceptance Month and Cal State LA. Now, Cal State LA alum Will Baker always loved films, and after graduation wanted to make a mark in Hollywood. He is certainly doing that, but in a bit of an unusual way. Baker is helping put on the inaugural San Quentin Film Festival. And yes, that is referring to the prison, San Quentin. Joining me now is Will Baker. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh my gosh, it is my pleasure to speak with you.
Tell us a little bit about this film festival. How did it get started?
The San Quentin Film Festival, it's the first film festival ever held inside a prison. Corey and Rasan Thomas, no relation, Corey Thomas, Rasan, New York Thomas, they're our founders and co-directors. This is really their brainchild, this festival. And Corey met Rasan because Corey is a longtime volunteer at the San Quentin Media Center. And Rasan, who is a former resident of San Quentin Rehabilitation Center, he directed an award-winning documentary called Friendly Signs. And he also produced What These Walls Don't Hold, directed by Adam O'Chan. And that won at the San Francisco International Film Festival. And this was all while he was still a resident at San Quentin. So he was already making the connections and seeing the benefit of being in film. When he was released, he just wanted to bring that back to the other residents.
And nobody would necessarily assume that there is film study and film practice taking place in a correctional facility like this.
Yeah. And, you know, specifically for San Quentin, you know, Governor Newsom, you know, he's using this as like a test project in some ways of showing that there are opportunities for rehabilitation for the residents there. They are serving their time, but it doesn't mean that their time doesn't need to be meaningful. And the San Quentin Media Center is a spot where a lot of residents gravitate to because there's creativity. There's an ability to tell their own story so that they can share their experience from an authentic way. There's a lot of the time, especially in Hollywood, where their stories are told through a very Vaseline lens, if you will, and that Hollywood ending. And it doesn't speak true to the experience of what actually goes, what actually the residents inside of these rehabilitation centers, San Quentin's Rehabilitation Center, actually experience and go through.
And you've got two interesting juries. You've got the juries of the industry professionals who are judging the films that come from the incarcerated, the residents at San Quentin, and anyone who has formerly been incarcerated anywhere. And then you have the jury of the residents judging films that were made by professionals. So it's an interesting convergence of, you know, who's grading whose work.
The industry jury was brought together so that they would view the films of formerly incarcerated, so they would see the true authentic and the inclusion of authentic stories on the screen, where the inside jury is meant to be the critiquer of how the industry is making stories that are not influenced by authenticity of that experience. You know, we have 19 jurors on the industry jury who, actors, directors, writers, screenplay writers, showrunners, film festival directors, it's a true culmination of what this industry is. And we have these individuals who are interested in film, watching these films and trying to have this conversation of, this is authentic. This is what we see as being true and real. This is how we should be portrayed on screen. It's what we're seeing in the industry already on so many different other initiatives that it only made sense for it to extend to a very large population in America whose stories have yet to be authentically told in a mass way. The main thing about all of these stories is that there's not nothing you can't connect to with these individuals because they're human. We're all human at our core. And, you know, it's just, that's, I think what brought me to this is that I have been, you know, I've studied film at Cal State LA. I've seen a lot of film at Cal State LA. I've been obsessed with film and movies for all my life. That's why I got the major, thankfully. But what amazes me is how very little our stories really skew from the mainstream pattern of it all.
Where can people go if they want to get tickets, participate, watch, be involved?
On October 10th, that's when the actual festival is happening inside San Quentin Rehabilitation Center. It's a 2-day event, but it's not open to the public.
The nature of a film festival inside of a prison.
But what I can tell people is we actually have a virtual festival component. So even though you can't be there in person, you are able to see the official selections that are streaming. There's some bonus content. There is an incredible feature-length documentary that was actually submitted as a short that was produced all on the inside of San Quentin called Healing Through Hula. And if you go to sanquentinfilmfestival.com, you can find the virtual festival page there. We have merch, which is really cool and limited edition. But the virtual festival starts on October 10th and then goes through October 15th. So grab your tickets to see some incredible films and shorts.
Will Baker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show provides news about issues affecting the undercovered areas Cal State LA students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. That's all we have for now. Our executive producers are Professors Julie Patel-Liss and me, April Brown. Our hosts for this episode were Julie Patel-Liss, Tupac Zapata, and me. The UT Community News Editors this semester are Quina Dong, Cynthia Harbo, Tupac Zapata, Giselle Mauricio, Ashley Romero, Jonathan Chung, and Thomas Davila. The Community News Reporters are Kara Alexander, Jessica Galan, Laura Barney, Leslie Hudson, Anjanette Guile, Jose Cabrera, Emmanuel Martinez, and Haley Mosley. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. Special thanks to our Cal State LA faculty and staff, Christina Hackle, Tony Cox, Joanne Lightford-Powell, Chanel Curry, Nithin Patel, Andrew Campa, Julian Reyes, Jane McKeever, Jeff Foost, and Jesus Cruz. I'm April Brown. For all of us at Cal State LA, thank you for listening.
For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Negwa Ibrahim. I just wanted to take a moment to talk with you all about the fund drive that we're in right now for KPFK. As you know, we are 100% community sponsored. We take no money from any sort of corporate entities. That gives us the opportunity to really talk about the issues that are affecting the world from a place of truth. And not from a place that's influenced by corporate greed, that's influenced by ulterior motives. Rather, we have the opportunity through being community funded, through listener support, to really be able to deliver programming that is speaking truth to power. And we want to be able to continue to do that. You can make your pledge to kpfk.org/donate, or you can call in at 818-985-5735. If you appreciate what we are about and what we're trying to do every day in collaboration with you all, please make sure to donate. Once again, you can donate at kpfk.org/donate or call in at 818-985-5735. Thanks so much for joining us.